Disc 5.
Ubba's banner, the famous raven on its three-sided cloth, was midway between the two paths, both of which were strongly guarded by East Anglian shield walls, and any attack up either path would mean that a few of our men would have to attack a lot of theirs. And Ubba must have been having second thoughts, for he was hesitating. I described all that to Raven. "It doesn't do," he told me, "to lose men, even if we win." "But if we kill lots of theirs?" I asked. "They have more men. We have few. If we kill 1,000 of theirs, then they will have another 1,000 tomorrow. But if we lose 100 men, then we must wait for more ships to replace them."
"More ships are coming," Breeder said.
"I doubt there will be any more this year," Raven said.
"No," she insisted, "now."
And she pointed, and I saw four ships nosing their way through the tangle of low islands and shallow creeks.
"Tell me," Raven said urgently.
"Four ships," I said, "coming from the west."
"From the west, not the east?"
"From the west," I insisted, which meant they were not coming from the sea, but from one of the four rivers that flowed into the Yawash.
"Prows?" Raven demanded.
"No beasts on the prows," I said, "just plain wooden posts."
"Oars?"
10 aside, I think, maybe 11, but there are far more men than rowers.
"English ships?"
Raven sounded amazed, for other than small fishing craft and some tubby cargo vessels, the English had few ships. Yet these four were warships, built long and sleek like the Danish ships, and they were creeping through the mazy waterways to attack Ubba's beached fleet. I could see smoke trickling from the foremost ship, and knew they must have a brazier on board, and so were planning to burn the Danish boats and thus trap Ubba. But Ubba had also seen them, and already the Danish army was streaming back toward the camp. The leading English ship began to shoot fire arrows at the closest Danish boat, and though there was a guard on the boats, that guard was composed of the sick and the lame, and they were not strong enough to defend the ships against a seaborne attack.
"Boys!"
one of the guards bellowed.
"Go," Raven told us. "Go."
And Breeder, who considered herself as good as any boy, came with the twins and me. We jumped down to the beach and ran along the water's edge to where smoke was thickening above the beached Danish boat. Two English ships were shooting fire arrows now, while the last two attackers were trying to edge past their companions to reach more of our craft. Our job was to extinguish the fire, while the guards hurled spears at the English crews. I used a shield to scoop up sand that I dumped onto the fire. The English ships were close, and I could see they were made of new raw wood. A spear thumped close to me, and I picked it up and threw it back, though feebly, because it clattered against an oar and fell into the sea. The twins were not trying to put out the fire, and I hit one of them and threatened to hit him harder if they did not make an effort. But we were too late to save the first Danish ship, which was well ablaze. So we abandoned it and tried to rescue the next one. But a score of fire arrows slammed into the rowers' benches, another landed on the furled sail, and two of the boys were dead at the water's edge. The leading English ship turned to the beach then, its prow thick with men bristling with spears, axes and swords.
"Edmund!" they shouted. "Edmund!"
The bow grated on the beach, and the warriors jumped off to begin slaughtering the Danish ship guard. The big axes slammed down and blood spattered up the beach or was sluiced away by the tiny waves that washed the sand. I grabbed Breeder's hand and pulled her away, splashing through a shallow creek where tiny silver fish scattered in alarm.
"We have to save Raven," I told her.
She was laughing. Breeder always enjoyed chaos. Three of the English ships had beached themselves, and their crews were ashore, finishing off the Danish guards. The last ship glided on the falling tide, shooting fire arrows. But then Ubba's men were back in the camp, and they advanced on the English with a roar. Some men had stayed with the raven banner at the earthen wall to make sure King Edmund's forces could not swarm over the neck of the land to take the camp, but the rest came screaming and vengeful. The Danes love their ships. A ship, they say, is like a woman, or a sword sharp and beautiful, worth dying for, and certainly worth fighting for. and the East Anglians who had done so well had now made a mistake, for the tide was ebbing and they could not shove their boats off into the small waves. Some of the Danes protected their own unharmed boats by raining throwing axes, spears and arrows at the crew of the single enemy boat afloat, while the rest attacked the Englishmen ashore. That was a slaughter. That was Danish work. That was a fit fight for the Skulls to celebrate. Blood was thick on the tide line, blood slurping with the rise and fall of the small waves. Men screaming and falling, and all about them the smoke of the burning boats was whirling so that the hazed sun was red above a sand turned red, and in that smoke the rage of the Danes was terrible. It was then I first saw Ubba fight, and marvelled at him, for he was a bringer of death, a grim warrior, sword lover. He did not fight in a shield wall, but ran into his enemies, shield slamming one way as his war axe gave death in the other. And it seemed he was indestructible, for at one moment he was surrounded by East Anglian fighters. But there was a scream of hate, a clash of blade on blade, and Ubba came out of the tangle of men, his blade red, blood in his beard, trampling his enemies into the blood-rich tide and looking for more men to kill. Ragnar joined him, and Ragnar's men followed, harvesting an enemy beside the sea, screaming hate at men who had burned their ships. And when the screaming and killing were done, we counted 68 English bodies, and some we could not count, for they had run into the sea and drowned there, dragged down by the weight of weapons and armour. The sole East Anglian ship to escape was a ship of the dying, its new wooden flanks running with blood. The victorious Danes danced over the corpses they had made, then made a heap of captured weapons. There were 30 Danish dead, and those men were burned on a half-burned ship. Another 6 Danish craft had been destroyed, but Ubba captured the 3 beached English boats, which Ragnar declared to be pieces of shit. "It's astonishing they even floated," he said, kicking at a badly caulked strake. Yet the East Anglians had done well, I thought. They had made mistakes, but they had hurt Danish pride by burning dragon ships. And if King Edmund had attacked the wall protecting the camp, he might have turned the slaughter into a massacre of Danes. But King Edmund had not attacked. Instead, as his shipmen died beneath the smoke, he had marched away. He thought he was facing the Danish army by the sea, only to learn that the real attack had come by land. He had just learned that Ivar the Boneless was invading his land. And Ubba was enraged. The few English prisoners were sacrificed to Odin, their screams a call to the god that we needed his help. And next morning, leaving the burned boats like smoking black skeletons on the beach, we rowed the Dragon Fleet west. Chapter 4. King Edmund of East Anglia is now remembered as a saint, as one of those blessed souls who live forever in the shadow of God, or so the priests tell me. In heaven, they say, the saints occupy a privileged place, living on the high platform of God's great hall, where they spend their time singing God's praises. Forever. Just singing. Beorko always told me that it would be an ecstatic existence, but to me it seems very dull. The Danes reckon their dead warriors are carried to Valhalla, the corpse hall of Odin, where they spend their days fighting and their nights feasting and swiving. And I dare not tell the priests that this seems a far better way to endure the afterlife than singing to the sound of golden harps. I once asked a bishop whether there were any women in heaven. "Of course there are, my lord," he answered, happy that I was taking an interest in doctrine. "Many of the most blessed saints are women." "I mean women we can hump, bishop." He said he would pray for me. Perhaps he did. I do not know if King Edmund was a saint. He was a fool, that was for sure. He had given the Danes refuge before they attacked Eofric, and given them more than refuge. He had paid them coin, provided them with food, and supplied their army with horses, all on the 2 promises that they would leave East Anglia in the spring and that they would not harm a single churchman. They kept their promises, but now, 2 years later and much stronger, the Danes were back, and King Edmund had decided to fight them. He had seen what had happened to Mercia and Northumbria, and must have known his own kingdom would suffer the same fate. And so he gathered his ford and prayed to his god and marched to do battle. First he faced us by the sea. Then, hearing that Ivar was marching around the edge of the great watery wastes west of the Yawash, he turned about to confront him. Ubba then led our fleet up the Yawash, and we nosed into one of the rivers until the channel was so narrow our oars could not be used. And then men towed the boats, wading through waist-deep water until we could go no farther, and there we left the ships under guard while the rest of us followed soggy paths through endless marshland, until at long last we came to higher ground. No one knew where we were, only that if we went south we had to reach the road along which Edmund had marched to confront Ivar. Cut that road and we would trap him between our forces and Ivar's army. Which is precisely what happened. Ivar fought him, shield wall against shield wall, and we knew none of it until the first East Anglian fugitives came streaming eastward to find another shield wall waiting for them. They scattered rather than fight us. We advanced, and from the few prisoners we took, we discovered that Ivar had beaten them easily. That was confirmed next day when the first horsemen from Ivar's forces reached us. King Edmund fled southward. East Anglia was a big country. He could easily have found refuge in a fortress, or else he could have gone to Wessex. But instead, he put his faith in God and took shelter in a small monastery at Deak. The monastery was lost in the wetlands, and perhaps he believed he would never be found there. Or else, as I heard, one of the monks promised him that God would shroud the monastery in a perpetual fog in which the pagans would get lost. But the fog never came, and the Danes arrived instead. Ivar, Ubba, and their brother Halfdan rode to Deak, taking half their army, while the other half set about pacifying East Anglia, which meant raping, burning, and killing until the people submitted, which most did swiftly enough. East Anglia, in short, fell as easily as Mercia, and the only bad news for the Danes was that there had been unrest in Northumbria. Rumours spoke of some kind of revolt. Danes had been killed, and Ivar wanted that rising quenched. But he dared not leave East Anglia so soon after capturing it. So at Deak, he made a proposal to King Edmund that would leave Edmund as king, just as Burghred still ruled over Mercia. The meeting was held in the monastery's church, which was a surprisingly large hall made of timber and thatch, but with great leather panels hanging on the walls. The panels were painted with gaudy scenes. One of the pictures showed naked folk tumbling down to hell, where a massive serpent with a fanged mouth swallowed them up. "Corpse Ripper," Ragnar said with a shudder. "Corpse Ripper?" "A serpent that waits in Niflheim," he explained, touching his hammer amulet. Niflheim, I knew, was a kind of Norse hell. But unlike the Christian hell, Niflheim was icy cold. "Corpse Ripper feeds on the dead," Ragnar went on. "But he also gnaws at the tree of life. He wants to kill the whole world and bring time to an end." He touched his hammer again. Another panel behind the altar showed Christ on the cross, and next to it was a third painted leather panel that fascinated Ivar. A man, naked but for a loincloth, had been tied to a stake and was being used as a target by archers. At least a score of arrows had punctured his white flesh, but he still had a saintly expression and a secret smile, as though despite his troubles he was quite enjoying himself. "Who is that?" Ivar wanted to know. "The blessed Saint Sebastian." King Edmund was seated in front of the altar, and his interpreter provided the answer. Ivar, skull-eyes staring at the painting, wanted to know the whole story, and Edmund recounted how the blessed Saint Sebastian, a Roman soldier, had refused to renounce his faith, and so the emperor had ordered him shot to death with arrows.
"Yet he lived," Edmund said eagerly. "He lived because God protected him, and God be praised for that mercy."
"He lived?"
Ivar asked suspiciously.
So the Emperor had him clubbed to death instead, the interpreter finished the tale.
So he didn't live. He went to heaven, King Edmund said, so he lived.
Ubba intervened, wanting to have the concept of heaven explained to him, and Edmund eagerly sketched its delight. But Ubba spat in derision when he realized that the Christian heaven was Valhalla without any of the amusements.
And Christians want to go to heaven? He asked in disbelief.
Of course, the interpreter said.
Ubba sneered. He and his two brothers were attended by as many Danish warriors as could cram themselves into the church, while King Edmund had an entourage of two priests and six monks, who all listened as Ivar proposed his settlement. King Edmund could live, he could rule in East Anglia, but the chief fortresses were to be garrisoned by Danes, and Danes were to be granted whatever land they required, except for royal land. Edmund would be expected to provide horses for the Danish army, coin and food for the Danish warriors, and his third, what was left of it, would march under Danish orders. Edmund had no sons, but his chief men, those who lived, had sons who would become hostages to ensure that the East Anglians kept the terms Ivar proposed.
And if I say no? Edmund asked.
Ivar was amused by that.
We take the land anyway.
The king consulted his priests and monks. Edmund was a tall, spare man, bold as an egg, though he was only about 30 years old. He had protruding eyes, a pursed mouth, and a perpetual frown. He was wearing a white tunic that made him look like a priest himself.
What of God's church? He finally asked Ivar.
What of it?
Your men have desecrated God's altars, slaughtered his servants, defiled his image, and stolen his tribute.
The king was angry now. One of his hands was clenched on the arm of his chair that was set in front of the altar, while the other hand was a fist that beat time with his accusations.
Your God cannot look after himself?
Ubba inquired.
Our God is a mighty God, Edmund declared, the creator of the world, yet he also allows evil to exist to test us.
Amen, one of the priests murmured, as Ivar's interpreter translated the words.
He brought you, the king spat, pagans from the north. Jeremiah foretold this.
Jeremiah?
Ivar asked, quite lost now. One of the monks had a book, the first I had seen in many years, and he unwrapped its leather cover, paged through the stiff leaves, and gave it to the king, who reached into a pocket and took out a small ivory pointer that he used to indicate the words he wanted.
Quia malum ego, he thundered,
the pale pointer moving along the lines.
Adduco ab aquilone et contritionem magnam.
He stopped there, glaring at Ivar and some of the Danes, impressed by the forcefulness of the king's words, even though none of them understood a single one of them, touched their hammer charms. The priests around Edmund looked reproachfully at us. A sparrow flew in through a high window and perched for a moment on an arm of the high wooden cross that stood on the altar. Ivar's dread face showed no reaction to Jeremiah's words, and it finally dawned on the East Anglian interpreter, who was one of the priests, that the king's impassioned reading had meant nothing to any of us.
For I will bring evil from the north, he translated, and great destruction.
It is in the book, Edmund said fiercely, giving the volume back to the monk.
You can keep your church,
Ivar said carelessly.
It is not enough, Edmund said.
He stood up to give his next words more force.
I will rule here, he went on, and I will suffer your presence if I must.
And I will provide you with horses, food, coin, and hostages, but only if you and all of your men submit to God. You must be baptized.
That word was lost on the Danish interpreter and on the king's, and finally Ubba looked to me for help. You have to stand in a barrel of water, I said, remembering how Beoka had baptized me after my brother's death. And they pour more water over you.
They want to wash me?
Ubba asked, astonished. I shrugged. That's what they do, Lord.
You will become Christians, Edmund said, then shot me an irritated look. We can baptize in the river, boy. Barrels are not necessary.
They want to wash you in the river, I explained to Ivar and Ubba, and the Danes laughed. Ivar thought about it. Standing in a river for a few minutes was not such a bad thing, especially if it meant he could hurry back to quell whatever trouble afflicted Northumbria.
I can go on worshipping Odin once I'm washed? He asked. Of course not, Edmund said angrily. There is only one god. There are many gods, Ivar snapped back. Many. Everyone knows that.
There is only one god, and you must serve him. But we're winning, Ivar explained patiently, almost as if he talked to a child. Which means our gods are beating your one god. The king shuddered at this awful heresy.
Your gods are false gods, he said. They are turds of the devil. They are evil things who will bring darkness to the world. While our god is great, he is all-powerful, he is magnificent.
Show me, Ivar said. Those two words brought silence. The king, his priests, and his monks all stared at Ivar in evident puzzlement. Prove it, Ivar said, and his Danes murmured their support of the idea. King Edmund blinked, evidently lost for inspiration, then had a sudden idea and pointed at the leather panel on which was painted Saint Sebastian's experience of being an archer's target.
Our god spared the blessed Saint Sebastian from death by arrows, Edmund said. Which is proof enough, is it not?
But the man still died, Ivar pointed out.
Only because that was God's will.
Ivar thought about that.
So, would your god protect you from my arrows? He asked.
If it is his will, yes.
So, let's try, Ivar proposed. We shall shoot arrows at you, and if you survive, then we'll all be washed.
Edmund stared at the Dane, wondering if he was serious, then looked nervous when he saw that Ivar was not joking. The king opened his mouth, found he had nothing to say and closed it again. Then one of his tonsured monks murmured to him, and he must have been trying to persuade the king that God was suggesting this ordeal in order to extend his church, and that a miracle would result, and the Danes would become Christians, and we would all be friends and end up singing together on the high platform in heaven. The king did not look entirely convinced by this argument, if that was indeed what the monk was proposing, but the Danes wanted to attempt the miracle now, and it was no longer up to Edmund to accept or refuse the trial. A dozen men shoved the monks and priests aside, while more went outside to find bows and arrows. The king, trapped in his defense of God, was kneeling at the altar, praying as hard as any man has ever prayed. The Danes were grinning. I was enjoying it. I think I rather hoped to see a miracle. Not because I was a Christian, but because I just wanted to see a miracle. Beoka had often told me about miracles, stressing that they were the real proof of Christianity's truth, but I had never seen one. No one had ever walked on the water at Bebbanburg, and no lepers were healed there, and no angels had filled our night skies with blazing glory. But now, perhaps, I would see the power of God that Beoka had forever preached to me. Breeder just wanted to see Edmund dead.
Are you ready? Ivar demanded of the king.
Edmund looked at his priests and monks, and I wondered if he was about to suggest that one of them should replace him in this test of God's power. Then he frowned and looked back to Ivar.
I will accept your proposal, he said. That we shoot arrows at you? That I remain king here? But you want to wash me first.
We can dispense with that, Edmund said.
No, Ivar said. You have claimed your god is all-powerful, that he is the only god, so I want it proved. If you are right, then all of us will be washed. Are we agreed?
This question was asked of the Danes, who roared their approval.
Not me, Ravan said. I won't be washed.
We will all be washed, Ivar snarled.
And I realized he truly was interested in the outcome of the test. More interested, indeed, than he was in making a quick and convenient peace with Edmund. All men need the support of their god, and Ivar was trying to discover whether he had, all these years, been worshipping at the wrong shrine.
Are you wearing armor? He asked Edmund.
No. Best to be sure, Uba intervened, and glanced at the fatal painting. Strip him, he ordered.
The king and the churchman protested, but the Danes would not be denied, and King Edmund was stripped stark naked.
Breda enjoyed that.
He's puny, she said.
Edmund, the butt of laughter now, did his best to look dignified. The priests and monks were on their knees, praying, while six archers took their stance a dozen paces from Edmund.
We are going to find out, Ivar told us, stilling the laughter, whether the English god is as powerful as our Danish gods. If he is, and if the king lives, then we shall become Christians, all of us.
Not me, Ravan said again, but quietly so that Ivar could not hear. Tell me what happens, Uhtred.
It was soon told. Six arrows hit, the king screamed, blood spattered the altar, he fell down, he twitched like a gaffed salmon, and six more arrows thumped home. Edmund twitched some more, and the archers kept on shooting, though their aim was bad because they were half helpless with laughter, and they went on shooting until the king was as full of feathered shafts as a hedgehog has spikes. And he was quite dead by then. He was bloodied, his white skin red-laced, open-mouthed, and dead. His god had failed him miserably. Nowadays, of course, that story's never told. Instead, children learn how brave St. Edmund stood up to the Danes, demanded their conversion, and was murdered. So now he is a martyr and saint, warbling happily in heaven. But the truth is that he was a fool and talked himself into martyrdom. The priests and monks wailed, so Ivar ordered them killed as well. Then he decreed that Earl Godrim, one of his chiefs, would rule in East Anglia and that Halfdan would savage the country to quench the last sparks of resistance. Godrim and Halfdan would be given a third of the army to keep East Anglia quiet, while the rest of us would return to subdue the unrest in Northumbria. So now East Anglia was gone, and Wessex was the last kingdom of England. We returned to Northumbria, half rowing and half sailing the Wind Viper up the gentle coast, then rowing against the river's currents as we travelled up the Humber, then the Ouse, until Jofrick's walls came into sight. And there we hauled the ship onto dry land so she would not rot through the winter. Ivar and Ubba returned with us, so that a whole fleet skimmed the river, oars dipping, beastless prows bearing branches of green oak to show we came home victorious. We brought home much treasure. The Danes set much store by treasure. Their men followed their leaders because they know they will be rewarded with silver. And in the taking of three of England's four kingdoms, the Danes had amassed a fortune that was shared among the men, and some, a few, decided to take their money back home to Denmark. Most stayed, for the richest kingdom remained undefeated, and men reckoned they would all become as wealthy as gods once Wessex fell. Ivar and Ubba had come to Jofrick expecting trouble. They had their shields displayed on the flanks of their ships, but whatever unrest had disturbed Northumbria had not affected the city, and King Egbert, who ruled at the pleasure of the Danes, sulkily denied there had been any rising at all. Archbishop Wulfhere said the same.
There is always banditry, he declared loftily, and perhaps you heard rumours of it.
Or perhaps you are deaf, Ivar snarled, and Ivar was right to be suspicious.
For once it was known that the army had returned, messengers came from Elderman Riksig of Dunholm. Dunholm was a great fortress on a high crag that was almost surrounded by the river Weir, and the crag and the river made Dunholm almost as strong as Bebbanburg. It was ruled by Riksig, who had never drawn his sword against the Danes. When we attacked Jofrek and my father was killed, Riksig had claimed to be sick and his men had stayed home. But now he sent servants to tell Ivar that a band of Danes had been slaughtered at Geruum. That was the site of a famous monastery, where a man called Bede wrote a history of the English church that Beoka had always praised to me, saying that when I learned to read properly, I could give myself the treat of reading it. I've yet to do so, but I have been to Geruum and seen where the book was written, for Ragnar was asked to take his men there and discover what had happened. It seemed 6 Danes, all of them masterless men, had gone to Geruum and demanded to see the monastery's treasury, and when the monks claimed to be penniless, the 6 had started killing. But the monks had fought back, and as there were over 100 of monks, and as they were helped by some men from the town, they succeeded in killing the 6 Danes who had then been spitted on posts and left to rot on the foreshore. Thus far, as Ragnar admitted, the fault lay with the Danes. But the monks, encouraged by this slaughter, had marched west up the River Tyne and attacked a Danish settlement where there were only a few men, those too old or too sick to travel south with the army, and there they had raped and killed at least 100 of women and children, proclaiming that this was now a holy war. More men had joined the makeshift army, but Elderman Riksig, fearing the revenge of the Danes, had sent his own troops to disperse them. He had captured a good number of the rebels, including 12 monks who were now held at his fortress above the river at Dunholm. All of this we heard from Riksig's messengers, then from folk who had survived the massacre, and one of those was a girl the same age as Ragnar's daughter, and she said the monks had raped her one at a time, and afterward they had forcibly baptized her. She said there had been nuns present as well, women who had urged the men on and had taken part in the slaughter afterward. "Nests of vipers," Ragnar said. I had never seen him so angry, not even when Sven had exposed himself to Thyra. We dug up some of the Danish dead, and all were naked and all were blood-spattered. They had all been tortured. A priest was found and made to tell us the names of the chief monasteries and nunneries in Northumbria. Geruum was one, of course, and just across the river was a large nunnery, while to the south, where the Weir met the sea, was a second monastery. The house at Strunshall was close to Jofrek, and that held many nuns, while close to Bebbanburg, on the island that Beoka had always told me was sacred, was the monastery of Lindisfarina. There were many others, but Ragnar was content with the chief places, and he sent men to Ivar and Ubba, suggesting that the nuns of Strunshall should be dispersed, and any found to have joined the revolt should be killed. Then he set about Geruum. Every monk was killed. The buildings that were not made of stone were burned. The treasures, for they did indeed have silver and gold hidden beneath their church, were taken. I remember we discovered a great pile of writings, sheet upon sheet of parchments, all smothered in tight black writing. And I have no idea what the writings were, and now I never will, for they were all burned. And once Geruum was no more, we went south to the monastery, at the mouth of the Weir, and we did the same there, and afterward crossed the Tyne and obliterated the nunnery on the northern bank. The nuns there, led by their abbesses, deliberately scarred their own faces. They knew we were coming, and so, to deter rape, cut their cheeks and foreheads, and so met us all bloody, screaming and ugly. Why they did not run away, I do not know, but instead they waited for us, cursed us, prayed for heaven's revenge on us, and died. I never told Alfred that I took part in that famous harrowing of the northern houses. The tale is still told as evidence of Danish ferocity and untrustworthiness. Indeed, every English child is told the story of the nuns who cut their faces to the bone so that they would be too ugly to rape, though that did not work any more than King Edmund's prayers had saved him from arrows. I remember one Easter, listening to a sermon about the nuns, and it was all I could do not to interrupt and say that it had not happened as the priest described. The priest claimed that the Danes had promised that no monk or nun would ever be hurt in Northumbria, and that was not true. And he claimed that there was no cause for the massacres, which was equally false. And then he told a marvellous tale how the nuns had prayed and God had placed an invisible curtain at the nunnery gate, and the Danes had pushed against the curtain and could not pierce it. And I was wondering why, if the nuns had this invisible shield, they had bothered to scar themselves. But they must have known how the story would end, because the Danes were supposed to have fetched a score of small children from the nearby village and threatened to cut their throats unless the curtain was lifted, which it was. None of that happened. We arrived, they screamed, the young ones were raped, and then they died. But not all of them, despite the famous tales. At least two were pretty and not at all scarred. And both of them stayed with Ragnar's men, and one of them gave birth to a child who grew up to become a famous Danish warrior. Still, priests have never been great men for the truth, and I kept quiet, which was just as well. In truth, we never killed everybody, because Ravan drove it home to me that you always left one person alive to tell the tale, so that news of the horror would spread. Once the nunnery was burned, we went to Dunholm, where Ragnar thanked the Elderman Riksig, though Riksig was plainly shocked by the revenge the Danes had taken. "Not every monk and nun took part in the slaughter," he pointed out reprovingly.
"They are all evil," Ragnar insisted.
"Their houses," Riksig said, "are places of prayer and contemplation, places of learning."
"Tell me," Ragnar demanded,
"what use is prayer, contemplation, or learning? Does prayer grow wry? Does contemplation fill a fishing net? Does learning build a house or plough a field?"
Riksig had no answer to those questions, nor indeed did the Bishop of Dunholm, a timid man who made no protest at the slaughter, not even when Riksig meekly handed over his prisoners, who were put to death in various imaginative ways. Ragnar had become convinced that the Christian monasteries and nunneries were sources of evil, places where sinister rites were performed to encourage folk to attack the Danes, and he saw no point in letting such places exist. The most famous monastery of all, though, was that at Lindisfarina, the house where St. Cuthbert had lived, and the house that had first been sacked by the Danes 2 generations before. It had been that attack that had been portended by dragons in the sky, and whirlwinds churning the sea, and lightning storms savaging the hills. But I saw no such strange wonders as we marched north. I was excited. We were going close to Bebbanburg, and I wondered whether my uncle, the false Ealdorman Aelfric, would dare come out of his fortress to protect the monks of Lindisfarina, who would always look to our family for their safety. We all rode horses, 3 ships' crews, over 100 men, for it was late in the year, and the Danes did not like taking their ships into hard weather. We skirted Bebbanburg, riding in the hills, catching occasional glimpses of the fortress's wooden walls between the trees. I stared at it, seeing the fretting sea beyond, dreaming. We crossed the flat coastal fields and came to the sandy beach where a track led to Lindisfarina, but at high tide the track was flooded and we were forced to wait. We could see the monks watching us on the farther shore. "The rest of the bastards will be burying their treasures," Ragnar said. "If they have any left," I said. "They always have some left," Ragnar said grimly.
"When I was last here," Ravan put in, "we took a chest of gold, pure gold."
"A big chest?" Breda asked.
She was mounted behind Ravan, serving as his eyes this day. She came everywhere with us, spoke good Danish by now, and was regarded as bringing luck by the men who adored her.
"As big as your chest," Ravan said.
"Not much gold then," Breda said, disappointed.
"Gold and silver," Ravan reminisced, "and some walrus tusks. Where did they get those?"
The sea relented. The bickering waves slunk back down the long sands, and we rowed through the shallows, past the withies that marked the track, and the monks ran off. Small flickers of smoke marked where farmsteads dotted the island, and I had no doubt those folk were burying what few possessions they owned.
"Will any of these monks know you?"
Ragnar asked me. Probably. Does that worry you? It did, but I said it did not. And I touched Thor's hammer, and somewhere in my thoughts there was a tendril of worry that God, the Christian God, was watching me. Beok always said that everything we did was watched and recorded, and I had to remind myself that the Christian God was failing, and that Odin, Thor, and the other Danish gods were winning the war in heaven. Edmund's death had proved that, and so I consoled myself that I was safe. The monastery lay on the south of the island, from where I could see Bebbanburg on its crag of rock. The monks lived in a scatter of small timber buildings, thatched with rye and moss, and built about a small stone church. The abbot, a man called Egfrith, came to meet us carrying a wooden cross. He spoke Danish, which was unusual, and he showed no fear. "You are most welcome to our small island," he greeted us enthusiastically. "And you should know that I have one of your countrymen in our sick chamber." Ragnar rested his hands on the fleece-covered pommel of his saddle. "What is that to me?" he asked. "It is an earnest of our peaceful intentions, Lord," Egfrith said. He was elderly, grey-haired, thin, and missing most of his teeth, so that his words came out sibilant and distorted. "We are a humble house," he went on. "We tend the sick, we help the poor, and we serve God." He looked along the line of Danes, grim, helmeted men with their shields hanging by their left knees, swords and axes and spears bristling. The sky was low that day, heavy and sullen, and a small rain was darkening the grass. Two monks came from the church carrying a wooden box that they placed behind Egfrith, then backed away. "That is all the treasure we have," Egfrith said, "and you are welcome to it." Ragnar jerked his head at me and I dismounted, walked past the abbot and opened the box to find it was half full of silver pennies, most of them clipped and all of them dull because they were of bad quality. I shrugged at Ragnar as if to suggest they were poor reward. "You are Uhtred," Egfrith said. He had been staring at me. "So?" I answered belligerently.
"I heard you were dead, Lord," he said, "and I praise God you are not."
"You heard I was dead? That a Dane killed you?"
We had been talking in English, and Ragnar wanted to know what had been said, so I translated.
"Was the Dane called Wayland?" Ragnar asked Egfrith. "He is called that," Egfrith said.
"Is?"
"Wayland is the man lying here recovering from his wounds, Lord."
Egfrith looked at me again, as though he could not believe I was alive.
"His wounds?" Ragnar wanted to know. "He was attacked, Lord, by a man from the fortress, from Bebbanburg."
Ragnar, of course, wanted to hear the whole tale. It seemed Wayland had made his way back to Bebbanburg, where he claimed to have killed me, and so received his reward in silver coins, and he was escorted from the fortress by a half-dozen men, who included Eldwulf, the blacksmith who had told me stories in his forge. And Eldwulf had attacked Wayland, hacking an axe down into his shoulder before the other men dragged him off. Wayland had been brought here, while Eldwulf, if he still lived, was back in Bebbanburg. If Abbot Egfrith thought Wayland was his safeguard, he had miscalculated. Ragnar scowled at him.
"You gave Wayland shelter, even though you thought he had killed Uhtred?" he demanded. "This is a house of God," Egfrith said. "So we give every man shelter."
"Including murderers?"
Ragnar asked, and he reached behind his head and untied the leather lace that bound his hair.
"So, tell me, monk, how many of your men went south to help their comrades murder Danes?"
Egfrith hesitated, which was answer enough. And then Ragnar drew his sword, and the abbot found his voice.
"Some did, Lord," he admitted. "I could not stop them."
"You could not stop them?"
Ragnar asked, shaking his head so that his wet, unbound hair fell around his face.
"Yet you rule here?"
"I am the abbot, yes."
"Then you could stop them."
Ragnar was looking angry now. and I suspected he was remembering the bodies we had disinterred near Garum, the little Danish girls with blood still on their thighs. "Kill them," he told his men. I took no part in that killing. I stood by the shore and listened to the birds cry, and I watched Bebbanburg and heard the blades doing their work. And Breeder came to stand beside me, and she took my hand and stared south across the white-flecked grey to the great fortress on its crag.
"Is that your house?" she asked.
"That is my house."
"He called you Lord."
"I am a lord." She leaned against me.
"You think the Christian God is watching us?"
"No," I said, wondering how she knew that I'd been thinking about that very question.
"He was never our God," she said fiercely. "We worshipped Woden and Thor and Ysta and all the other gods and goddesses. And then the Christians came and we forgot our gods. And now the Danes have come to lead us back to them."
She stopped abruptly. "Did Ravan tell you that?"
"He told me some," she said, "but the rest I worked out. There's war between the gods, Uhtred, war between the Christian God and our gods. And when there is war in Asgard, the gods make us fight for them on earth."
"And we're winning?" I asked. Her answer was to point to the dead monks, scattered on the wet grass, their robes bloodied, and now that their killing was done, Ragnar dragged Wayland out of his sickbed. The man was plainly dying, for he was shivering and his wound stank, but he was conscious of what was happening to him. His reward for killing me had been a heavy bag of good silver coins that weighed as much as a newborn babe, and that we found beneath his bed, and we added it to the monastery's small hoard to be divided among our men. Wayland himself lay on the bloodied grass, looking from me to Ragnar.
"You want to kill him?"
Ragnar asked me.
"Yes," I said,
for no other response was expected. Then I remembered the beginning of my tale, the day when I had seen Ragnar oar dancing just off this coast, and how next morning Ragnar had brought my brother's head to Bebbanburg. "I want to cut off his head," I said. Wayland tried to speak, but could only manage a guttural groan. His eyes were on Ragnar's sword. Ragnar offered the blade to me.
"It's sharp enough," he said, "but you'll be surprised by how much force is needed. An axe would be better."
Wayland looked at me now. His teeth chattered and he twitched. I hated him. I had disliked him from the first, but now I hated him. Yet I was still oddly anxious about killing him, even though he was already half dead. I have learned that it is one thing to kill in battle, to send a brave man's soul to the corpse hall of the gods, but quite another to take a helpless man's life. And he must have sensed my hesitation, for he managed a pitiful plea for his life.
"I will serve you," he said.
"Make the bastard suffer," Ragnar answered for me.
"Send him to the corpse goddess, but let her know he's coming by making him suffer."
I do not think he suffered much. He was already so feeble that even my puny blows drove him to swift unconsciousness. But even so, it took a long time to kill him. I hacked away. I have always been surprised by how much effort is needed to kill a man. The Skalds make it sound easy, but it rarely is. We are stubborn creatures. We cling to life and are very hard to kill. But Wayland's soul finally went to its fate as I chopped and sawed and stabbed and at last succeeded in severing his bloody head. His mouth was twisted into a rictus of agony, and that was some consolation. Now I asked more favours of Ragnar, knowing he would give them to me. I took some of the poorer coins from the hoard, then went to one of the larger monastery buildings and found the writing place where the monks copied books. They used to paint beautiful letters on the books, and before my life was changed at Jofurik, I used to go there with Beoka, and sometimes the monks would let me daub scraps of parchment with their wonderful colours. I wanted the colours now. They were in bowls, mostly as powder, a few mixed with gum, and I needed a piece of cloth, which I found in the church. A square of white linen that had been used to cover the sacraments. Back in the writing place, I drew a wolf's head in charcoal on the white cloth and then I found some ink and began to fill in the outline. Breeder helped me, and she proved to be much better at making pictures than I was, and she gave the wolf a red eye and a red tongue, and flecked the black ink with white and blue that somehow suggested fur. And once the banner was made, we tied it to the staff of the dead abbot's cross. Ragnar was rummaging through the monastery's small collection of sacred books, tearing off the jewel-studded metal plates that decorated their front covers. And once he had all the plates, and once my banner was made, we burned all the timber buildings. The rain stopped as we left. We trotted across the causeway, turned south, and Ragnar, at my request, went down the coastal track until we reached the place where the road crossed the sands to Bebbanburg. We stopped there, and I untied my hair so that it hung loose. I gave the banner to Breeder, who would ride Raven's horse while the old man waited with his son, and then, a borrowed sword at my side, I rode home. Breeder came with me as standard bearer, and the two of us cantered along the track. The sea broke white to my right and slithered across the sands to my left. I could see men on the walls and up on the low gate watching, and I kicked the horse, making it gallop, and Breeder kept pace, her banner flying above, and I curbed the horse where the track turned north to the gate, and now I could see my uncle. He was there, Elfric the Treacherous, thin-faced, dark-haired, gazing at me from the low gate. And I stared up at him so he would know who I was. And then I threw Wayland's severed head onto the ground where my brother's head had once been thrown. I followed it with the silver coins. I threw 30 coins. The Judas price. I remembered that church tale. It was one of the few that I had liked. There were archers on the wall, but none drew. They just watched. I gave my uncle the evil sign, the devil's horns made with the two outer fingers, and then I spat at him, turned and trotted away. He knew I was alive now, knew I was his enemy, and knew I would kill him like a dog if ever I had the chance. Uhtred, Breeder called. She had been looking behind, and I twisted in the saddle to see that one warrior had jumped over the wall, had fallen heavily, but was now running toward us. He was a big man, heavily bearded, and I thought I could never fight such a man. And then I saw the archers loose their arrows, and they flecked the ground about the man, who I now saw was Eldwulf the smith.
"Lord Uhtred!" Eldwulf called. "Lord Uhtred!"
I turned the horse and went to him, shielding him from the arrows with my horse's bulk. But none of the arrows came close, and I suspect, looking back on that distant day, that the bowmen were deliberately missing.
"You live, Lord!"
Eldwulf beamed up at me. "I live."
"Then I come with you,"
he said firmly.
"But your wife, your son," I asked.
"My wife died, Lord, last year, and my son was drowned while fishing."
"I am sorry," I said. An arrow skidded through the dune grass, but it was yards away.
"Woden gives and Woden takes away," Eldwulf said, "and he has given me back my lord."
He saw Thor's hammer about my neck, and because he was a pagan, he smiled, and I had my first follower, Eldwulf the smith.
"He's a gloomy man, your uncle,"
Eldwulf told me as we journeyed south.
"Miserable as shit he is. Even his new son won't cheer him up."
"He has a son?"
"Elfric the Younger, he's called, and he's a bonny wee thing, healthy as you like. Guthr's sick, though. She won't last long. And you, Lord, you look well."
"I am well."
"You'd be 12 now."
13.
"A man, then. Is that your woman?"
He nodded at Breeder.
"My friend."
"No meat on her," Eldwulf said. "So better as a friend."
The smith was a big man, almost 40 years old, with hands, forearms and face black scarred from countless small burns from his forge. He walked beside my horse, his pace apparently effortless despite his advanced years.
"So, Tell me about these Danes, he said,
casting a dubious look at Ragnar's warriors. They're led by Earl Ragnar, I said, who is the man who killed my brother. He's a good man.
He's the one who killed your brother? Eldwulf seemed shocked.
Destiny is everything, I said, which might have been true, but also avoided having to make a longer answer.
You like him?
He's like a father to me. You'll like him.
He's still a Dane, though, isn't he, Lord? They might worship the right gods, Eldwulf said grudgingly, but I'd still like to see them gone.
Why?
Why?
Eldwulf seemed shocked that I had asked.
Because this isn't their land, Lord, that's why. I want to walk without being afraid. I don't want to touch my forelock to a man just because he has a sword. There's one law for them and another for us.
There's no law for them, I said.
If a Dane kills a Northumbrian,
Eldwulf said indignantly,
what can a man do? There's no Wergild, no reeve to see, no lord to seek justice.
That was true. Wergild was the blood price of a man's life, and every person had a Wergild. A man's was more than a woman's, unless she was a great woman, and a warrior's was greater than a farmer's. But the price was always there, and a murderer could escape being put to death if the family of the murdered man would accept the Wergild. The reeve was the man who enforced the law, reporting to his eldermen, but that whole careful system of justice had vanished since the Danes had come. There was no law now except what the Danes said it was, and that was what they wanted it to be, and I knew that I revelled in that chaos. But then I was privileged. I was Ragnar's man, and Ragnar protected me. But without Ragnar, I would be no better than an outlaw or a slave.
Your uncle doesn't protest, Eldwulf went on, but Beorca did. You remember him, a red-eared priest with a shriveled hand and crossed eyes.
I met him last year, I said.
You did? Where?
He was with Alfred of Wessex.
Wessex? Eldwulf said, surprised. Long way to go. But he was a good man, Beorca, despite being a priest. He ran off because he couldn't stand the Danes. Your uncle was furious, said Beorca deserved to be killed.
Doubtless, I thought, because Beorca had taken the parchments that proved me to be the rightful elderman. My uncle wanted me killed too, I said, and I never thanked you for attacking Wayland.
Your uncle was going to give me to the Danes for that, he said. Only no Dane complained, so he did nothing.
You're with the Danes now, I said, and you'd better get used to it. Eldwulf thought about that for a moment.
Why not go to Wessex?
He asked. Because the West Saxons want to turn me into a priest, I said, and I want to be a warrior.
Go to Mercia, then, Eldwulf suggested.
That's ruled by the Danes.
But your uncle lives there.
My uncle?
Your mother's brother.
He was astonished that I did not know my own family.
He's Elderman Ethelwulf, if he still lives.
My father never talked about my mother, I said.
Because he loved her. She was a beauty, your mother, a piece of gold, and she died giving birth to you.
Ethelwulf, I said.
If he lives.
But why go to Ethelwulf when I had Ragnar? Ethelwulf was family, of course, but I'd never met him, and I doubted he even remembered my existence, and I had no desire to find him, and even less desire to learn my letters in Wessex. So I would stay with Ragnar. I said as much to Eldwulf. He's teaching me to fight, I said.
Learn from the best, eh? Eldwulf said grudgingly. That's how you become a good smith. Learn from the best.
Eldwulf was a good smith, and despite himself he came to like Ragnar, for Ragnar was generous, and he appreciated good workmanship. A smithy was added onto our home near Sunningthwaite, and Ragnar paid good silver for a forge, an anvil, and the great hammers, tongs, and files that Eldwulf needed. It was late winter before all was ready, and then ore was purchased from Jofurik, and our valley echoed to the clang of iron on iron, and even on the coldest days the smithy was warm, and men gathered there to exchange stories or to tell riddles. Eldwulf was a great man for riddles, and I would translate for him as he baffled Ragnar's Danes. Most of his riddles were about men and women and what they did together, and those were easy enough to guess, but I liked the complicated ones. "My father and mother gave me up for dead," one riddle began. "Then a loyal kinswoman wrapped and protected me, and I killed all her children, but she still loved me and fed me until I rose above the dwelling houses of men and so left her." I could not guess that one, nor could any of the Danes. And Eldwulf refused to give me the answer even when I begged him. And it was only when I told the riddle to Breeda that I learned the solution. "A cuckoo, of course," she said instantly. She was right, of course. By spring, the forge needed to be larger, and all that summer Eldwulf made metal for swords, spears, axes and spades. I asked him once if he minded working for the Danes, and he just shrugged.
"I worked for them in Bebbanburg," he said, "because your uncle does their bidding."
"But there are no Danes in Bebbanburg?"
"None," he admitted, "but they visit and are made welcome. Your uncle pays them tribute."
He stopped suddenly, interrupted by a shout of what I thought was pure rage. I ran out of the smithy to see Ragnar standing in front of the house, while approaching up the track was a crowd of men led by a mounted warrior. And such a warrior. He had a mail coat, a fine helmet hanging from the saddle, a bright painted shield, a long sword, and arms thick with rings. He was a young man with long fair hair and a thick gold beard, and he roared back at Ragnar like a rutting stag. Then Ragnar ran toward him, and I half thought the young man would draw the sword and kick at his horse, but instead he dismounted and ran uphill, and when the two met, they embraced and thumped each other's backs. And Ragnar, when he turned toward us, had a smile that would have lit the darkest crypt of hell. "My son!" he shouted up at me. "My son!" It was Ragnar the Younger, come from Ireland with a ship's crew. And though he did not know me, he embraced me, lifting me off the ground, whirled his sister round, thumped Rorik, kissed his mother, shouted at the servants, scattered gifts of silver chain links, and petted the hounds. A feast was ordered, and that night he gave us his news, saying he now commanded his own ship, that he had come for a few months only, and that Ivar wanted him back in Ireland by the spring. He was so like his father, and I liked him immediately, and the house was always happy when Ragnar the Younger was there. Some of his men lodged with us, and that autumn they cut trees and added a proper hall to the house, a hall fit for an earl with big beams and a high gable on which a boar's skull was nailed. "You were lucky," he told me one day. We were thatching the new roof, laying down the thick rye straw and combing it flat. "Lucky? That my father didn't kill you at Jofurik." "I was lucky," I agreed. "But he was always a good judge of men," he said, passing me a pot of ale. He perched on the roof ridge and gazed across the valley. "He likes it here." "It's a good place. What about Ireland?" He grinned. "Borg and Rock, Uhtred, and the Skraelings are vicious." The Skraelings were the natives. "But they fight well, and there's silver there, and the more they fight, the more silver we get. Are you going to drink all that ale, or do I get some?" I handed him back the pot and watched as the ale ran down his beard as he drained it. "I like Ireland well enough," he said when he had finished. "But I won't stay there. I'll come back here, find land in Wessex, raise a family, get fat." "Why don't you come back now?" "Because Ivar wants me there, and Ivar's a good lord." He frightens me. "A good lord should be frightening." "Your father isn't." "Not to you. But what about the men he kills? Would you want to face Earl Ragnar the Fearless in a shield wall?" "No." "So, he is frightening," he said, grinning. Go and take Wessex, he said, and find the land that will make me fat.
End of disc 5.